Hello, and welcome to World of Warbirds. I'm Brian Pierce. Have you joined me over at Patreon yet? That's where the images to accompany the episode are, and those are free to everyone. If you do join, you get early access to episodes and special bonuses. You also get the satisfaction of knowing that you are helping to keep this podcast going. If you are presently listening to this through Patreon, or if you're one of my PayPal supporters, well then, thank you for your encouragement. Now on to today's show. Introduction. Hello, Warbirders. So, this episode is part of a series. So if you're like me and prefer to listen to things in order, step out to take in the F4F Wildcat, and we'll be right here waiting for you. Also, speaking of doing things in order, some of you might be wondering, okay, Brian, last time you told us that after the FF1, or Fifi Fighter, Grumman had started this tradition of naming its aircraft with an F, then a number, and then another F. And you took us from the Fifi to the F2F through the F3F to all the evolutions of the F4F. And now you're trying to jump to the F6F, skipping over the F5F like a parent talking proudly about his children, but skipping over the mutant monstrosity that he has chained up in the attic. Yes, there was an F5F. And yes, it's a little bit of a monstrosity, and it doesn't quite fit in this narrative just yet. Firstly, it never went into production, and it was only a prototype. Secondly, it didn't even have a cat name, and it was called the Skyrocket instead. And so it doesn't belong in the cat series. So, for those reasons, yes, we are going to leave the F5F Skyrocket chained in the attic for now, and instead move on to the F6F. And we'll get back to the F5F later on. Design and development. Was there ever a fighter, or even any aircraft, that was more made to order than the Hellcat? I don't think so. More than any other I've studied, this bird was the result of the entire air procurement side of the equation, turning to the Wildcat pilots, taking a metaphorical order pad out of their apron and saying, "What do you have, sir?" Even well before the war, Grumman had been busy working since 1938 on an update to the F4F Wildcat. In the new fighter, the U.S. Navy was looking for more of everything. More speed, more loads, more endurance. To fit in all this extra fuel, engine, and load, the Hellcat was going to have to be bigger than the Wildcat. A lot bigger. At 33 feet long, it was 5 feet more than the Wildcat. With a wingspan of 42 feet, this was 6 feet longer than its little brother. Actually, in order to carry all the extra fuel and load and still have a workable takeoff and landing speed for carriers, the Hellcat had huge wings. Their surface area was even bigger than the vaunted P-47 Thunderbolt that everybody goes on about being so huge. The Wildcat had been purring on a 1,200 horsepower engine, while the new fighter was to get the Wright R-2600 Twin Cyclone, which was a two-row, 14-cylinder radial engine that growled out 1,700 horsepower, which seemed pretty good at the time. The new fighter was going to get upgraded landing gear. The Wildcat's landing gear gauge was narrow, and if you recall, pilots had to hand crank it up and down. It took 30 somewhat hard turns of a crank with a pilot's right hand to get the wheels up while he was trying to fly with the left. Supposedly, Wildcats had a bit of a wobble on climb-out as the pilots were cranking away on their gear. The new plane was to have much wider landing gear that would make operations on a pitching carrier deck easier, and it would be hydraulically powered, avoiding the tiresome chore of cranking during that, you know, critical time of climbing out. The gear would rotate and retract backwards into the wings and be covered by gear doors to eliminate drag. So there were changes planned, but nobody was going to be getting rid of the good stuff from the Wildcat. As the old saying goes, the baby was not going to be thrown out with the bathwater. The Hellcat would still have the Grumman patented Stowing folding system, where the wings ended up folded alongside the fuselage, leading edges pointed down. And it was time to start building prototypes. Prototypes. On the 26th of June 1942, the Grumman X F6F1 took off with test pilot Robert Leister Hall at the controls and made a 25-minute flight over Long Island, New York. The flight went well, but changes were already afoot. I start off this story by saying that the Hellcat was made to order, and requests were already starting to come in. And some of these requests were going right to the top of the command structure. Remember Butch O'Hare, the pilot who won the Medal of Honor in our last episode? According to Popular Science magazine, during his Medal of Honor ceremony on the 21st of April 1942, President Roosevelt himself asked O'Hare what he needed to defeat the Japanese. And Butch answered, in quotes, "something that will get us upstairs faster," close quotes. Grumman didn't just sit around waiting for ideas either. They went to the source to find out what the pilots wanted. The man who went was Jake Swerbel. He was one of the founders of Grumman, and he was a chief designer. Just after the Battle of Midway, he packed a bag and headed to the Pacific with a notebook to hear from the guys in the field. He was perhaps the perfect man for the job. Unlike Leroy Grumman, who was always known as Mr. Grumman by the employees, Jake Swerbel was known as Jake. He liked a sleeves-rolled-up, hands-on approach and was comfortable to talk to the guys on the production line, where problems could be solved directly and efficiently. Swerbel heard from pilots such as Jimmy Thatch, who also highlighted the need for better climb and speed. The U.S. Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics also put in a request for better pilot visibility. So, with a swiftness that seems almost completely unreal, the changes were incorporated into the second prototype. To get upstairs faster, the Hellcat was getting the 2,000 horsepower Pratt & Whitney double wasp 18-cylinder engine, the very same one that powered the Thunderbolt and the Corsair. To contain the monster engine, the airframe had to be strengthened. The cockpit was raised for better pilot visibility. The Wildcat already had a reputation for survivability, and the Hellcat was designed to add to that. The weight of a large man, 212 pounds of armor, was fitted around the cockpit, oil tank, and oil cooler. The windshield was bullet-resistant, and of course, the 250-gallon fuselage fuel tank was self-sealing. For extra fuel, a single 150-gallon disposable drop tank could be carried, or a bomb. To hand out punishment, the Hellcat was loaded too. Standard weapons were 6 50-caliber machine guns with 400 rounds per gun. Test pilot Bob Hall first took off with the airplane with the new engine on the 30th of July 1942, and the results were good. Performance was reported to have increased by 25% over the previous engine. Although not all was well. The new engine failed on the 17th of August, again with Bob Hall at the controls, and he was seriously injured during the crash landing in a farmer's field, and the aircraft was damaged. But the crash didn't slow things down. Not at all. Production. During that same month, in August 1942, ground was broken on the site of the new factory to build the new fighter. Now I've been using the name Hellcat already, but that was not the original name chosen for this fighter. Grumman had wanted to call it the Tomcat, but the Navy thought Tomcat was too risque. You're probably thinking, what's wrong with the name Tomcat? It's just a boy cat, right? Yes, that's the noun, but the verb, especially in the 1940s, meant, to quote dictionary.com, to pursue women in order to make sexual conquests. So imagine a modern plane being named the F-Boy. The plane might fly, but the name probably wouldn't. So the F-6F was dubbed Hellcat instead, and the name Tomcat was saved for later when the word and the world had changed a little bit. At the same time, in August 1942, the production jigs were made, and by October, aircraft parts were being produced and stored for assembly. In November, the first production plane rolled out. Not only was the Hellcat fast to get into production, its actual production speed was to become legendary. Because the initial design was so good, very little tinkering was needed to iron out bugs or glitches, so those manufacturing throttles could be opened up wide. There were only two production versions, the -3 and the -5. And so no time was wasted in churning out these litters of kitty cats. There even wasn't much changed when the -5 was introduced. The power was bumped up by another 200 horsepower with the R2800-10W engine with a water injection system. The engine cowling was a bit more streamlined, and spring-loaded control tabs were added to the ailerons. A flat-armored front panel replaced the earlier two-part curved plexiglass and internal armored panel. Production kept increasing from August 1942 until the end of the conflict, until a Hellcat was rolling off the assembly line 1 an hour, every hour, around the clock. Reliability never seemed to suffer. Grumman was the first company to be awarded an E for excellence by the U.S. government for its high-quality work. It also didn't hurt that the price per unit continued to drop, too, until the Hellcat was supposedly even cheaper to build than the bargain P-51 Mustang. Production isn't just a nut-and-bolt thing. It's about people, and more specifically, workers. Grumman provided services to workers, including daycare, personal counseling, auto repair, errand running, and even Christmas turkeys. Things intended to keep the workers happy and focused on turning out more Hellcats. In the end, they built 12,275 of them. Now, let's look at what the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the British Fleet Air Arm did with them. Operational history. Some of you know that I'm an educator for my day job. Back when I was a classroom teacher, sometimes during parent-teacher interviews, I would have parents of a student who was scoring in the mid-90s request an interview. I would sit across the desk from them, blinking, and think, what do I have to say here? Don't change a thing. Do nothing different. I've got nothing bad to say. That's what I was reminded of when I was researching the Hellcat. The pilots loved it. You can hear it in the nicknames they gave it. They loved the Wildcat's big brother for its superb flight characteristics, especially in its forgiving landing qualities after returning from exhausting and stressful missions. They had already named Grumman the Ironworks for its reliability of its products, but they also called the F-6F an aluminum tank for being able to come back full of holes, or missing significant chunks of airplane, or even with cylinders shot away. Pilots would tell of mostly holes where the airplane used to be, and how more air was going through it than around it, but still getting back to the carrier. And the deck crews loved them for their ease of maintenance. But perhaps even more important were the nicknames Zero Killer and Ace Maker. The Hellcat had been made to order to knock down Japanese aircraft, and it would do that in spades. This kitty first tasted blood on the 1st of September 1943 when it shot down a Kawanishi H-8K Emily flying boat. Over Tarawa, Hellcats bagged 30 Mitsubishi Zeros for the loss of only one of their own. Over Rabaul, New Britain, on the 11th of November 1943, Hellcats and F-4U Corsairs claimed another 50 enemy aircraft. During the Battle of the Philippine Sea on the 19 and 20th June 1944, Japan lost somewhere around 600 aircraft. Nobody's really sure, and now some of them were due to US AA fire, but a good number were shot down, with a major proportion being knocked down by Hellcats, who only traded 24 lost for the bargain. It was a trend that would not end until the shooting stopped. Hellcats claimed more than 5,000 confirmed victories over enemy aircraft during the war, giving a 19-to-1 kill ratio. 305 Hellcat pilots became aces. Ace maker, indeed. Hellcats weren't just hell on Japanese aircraft. They also excelled in ground attack or shipping attack, especially when the capability to carry 6 5-inch high-velocity aircraft rockets was added. It is estimated that Hellcat pilots fired more than 60,000 rockets on land targets and enemy shipping during the war. New bomb racks allowed 4,000 pounds of bombs to be carried, making this fighter into a formidable bomber too. Hellcats were even able to use the Tiny Tim rocket near the end of the war. This bunker buster type rocket wasn't so tiny. It was 10 feet long, weighed 1,300 pounds, and flung a 150-pound semi-armor-piercing high-explosive warhead almost a mile, where it could wreck such items such as bridges, guns, pillboxes, ships, or tanks. Its rocket motor was so powerful that it could actually damage the wing it was hanging from. So a system had to be devised whereby the rocket would fall and a lanyard attached to the wing would yank and fire the motor when it was safely clear. Eventually, even night wasn't a safe time for the Japanese when it came to avoiding this hunting cat. The U.S. Navy's night fighter program, they called Project Affirm, initially experimented with both Corsairs and Hellcats. But as the F-6F was considered much easier to land and a very stable gun platform, the Hellcat was chosen as the night fighter. To give the cat eyes to see in the dark, initially the AN/APS-4, Army-Navy, Airborne Pulse Search Equipment, was mounted in a bulbous pod under the starboard wing. This weighed 180 pounds and saw out to 4 miles. But only 18 Hellcats were installed with it. The rest got the newer APS-6 radar. This unit was heavier by about 70 pounds, but it could detect aircraft at 5.5 miles, a large ship at over 20 miles, or a fleet formation at 60 miles. It could get the pilot in as close as 400 feet. It also had a handy feature that would tell the pilot if his target was above or below him, all displayed on the same scope mounted on the control panel. Of course, fighting at night didn't just mean throwing in a radar unit. Cockpit lighting with red instrument panel lights needed to be perfected. Flat windscreens help reduce glare, and a radar altimeter help with providing the exact height information above the sea at night. To avoid being hunted themselves, an APS-13 tail warning radar kept an eye on the fighter's own 6 o'clock position. If something was there, a light and a bell would warn the pilot. Hellcat night fighters also had an extra 20mm cannon installed, just to make sure that a fleeting shot in the dark would bring down its quarry. Lastly, the pilots needed very specialized training, and it was a 29-week course to produce a qualified Hellcat night fighter pilot. Lastly, as if they weren't already doing enough, there was also a photographic reconnaissance Hellcat with a camera installed in the rear fuselage. Not only did Hellcats serve with the U.S. Navy and U.S. Marine Corps, almost 1,300 F-6Fs went to the British Fleet Air Arm through Lend-Lease. They initially called them the Gannet, but then thank God they just started using the Hellcat name. I'm sorry, I just keep remembering the old Monty Python bookstore sketch where the gentleman says that he doesn't like the Gannet because they wet their nests. But then again, you can't get a much better kick-ass warbird name than Hellcat, can you anyway? So, picture this. It is the 3rd of April, 1944, just after midnight. A formation of battleships and aircraft carriers is plowing through the ocean towards the enemy. The flight crews were woken up just after midnight. They attended their briefing by the strike leader at 1:15 a.m., and the air crews began climbing into their Corsairs and Wildcats and Hellcats and others at 4 a.m., and started launching 15 minutes later, while the fleet was still about 120 miles from their target. An enemy super battleship. Are we in the Pacific? Was this an American fleet going hunting for the battleship Yamato? Or maybe her other super battleship sister, the Musashi? No, this was a British fleet going after the German battleship Tirpitz. In my setup, I conveniently left out mentioning the Fairey Barracuda dive bombers that would be delivering the actual punch of the attack, because that would have given it away. But this was Operation Tungsten, a plan to knock out the Tirpitz. The Tirpitz had been and would remain a boogeyman to the Brits for a long time. The German battleship lurked in Norwegian fjords like a deadly sea monster, threatening the convoys which sailed through the Arctic Sea to get to the Soviet Union. The Brits wanted the monster gone. They had tried before. Torpedo bombers from HMS Victorious had tried to hit her. They really tried. They dropped 20 torpedoes without even one hit. Multiple times in the next 2 years, the RAF and the Soviet Air Forces had taken a crack at her. In September 1943, two British midget submarines had snuck in and placed explosive charges in the water under her. The resulting damage to Tirpitz had put her out of service for 6 months. But now, in early 1944, it seemed that she was approaching operational status again. The convoys to Russia would be again threatened, and also the Allied warships that had been tasked for keeping her bottled up in Norway would soon all be needed for Overlord and D-Day. The threat in the north needed to be eliminated. So early in the morning of the 3rd of April 1944, the first wave of 21 Fairey Barracuda dive bombers, escorted by 20 Hellcats and Martlets, launched. They formed up and turned for Norway, flying at the insanely low altitude of just 50 feet above the waves to stay below radar. 20 miles out, they began their climb to 7,000 feet. Just before 5:30 a.m., they pounced on Tirpitz from over the hills. And it was just in time. On that morning, the crew of the Tirpitz was preparing to sail her for high-speed trials following her repairs, and they were literally just untying her. Her five destroyer escorts had already just left. Which was lucky for the Brits, as their guns would not be there to help join in the defense. The attack achieved almost perfect surprise, and then the highly coordinated beating began. Actually, it was the heroes of our series, the Grumman Wildcats and Hellcats, that kicked off the party. When they dove in to spray 50 cal bullets all over the AA emplacements, on the shore, on the AA ships nearby, and on the Tirpitz herself. This action allowed for the first group of Barracudas to then drop smaller size 500 and 600 pound bombs on the Tirpitz. Again, hopefully to knock out some of the battleship's anti-aircraft guns before the finale killing attack began. Lastly, 1,600-pound armor-piercing bombs were dropped from 3,500 feet to hopefully punch through Tirpitz's deck armor, while other Barracudas dropped anti-submarine bombs in the water beside the ship to hopefully cause underwater hull damage. One Barracuda crashed during the attack with the loss of its three-man crew, but the rest were back on the flat tops by 6:40. Meanwhile, back at the Tirpitz, at 6:30, the second wave struck. Again, the Hellcats and Wildcats used their 50 cals to hose down the anti-aircraft batteries on land and on the ships while the Barracudas got into place for their attack. You'd think that the second raid would have gotten it much worse than the first, but no. The smoke screen that had been put up to try to hide the battleship actually helped the Brits, as the AA gunners had a hard time seeing the attacking birds. Again, a Barracuda and its crew was lost, and a damaged Hellcat had to ditch next to a destroyer, but everyone else made it back to the carriers. Although there were no knockout blows, the attack was considered a great success. Two of the submarine bombs had blown holes in the hull, causing flooding. None of the 15 armor-piercing bombs had punched all the way through, perhaps because they were released too late in order to increase their chances of hitting. Although when they did hit, they didn't have the velocity to punch through. 15% of the battleship's crew was killed in action or wounded, many hit by the strafing Grummans, and the battleship's topside was a mess. The Tirpitz would be out of action for months. Further carrier-based raids would be conducted that year, but in the end, it would be Bomber Command's Lancasters and their Tallboy bombs that would finally give the coup de grace to the Tirpitz. Pilots. The Hellcat pilot we're going to profile today is Hamilton McWhirter III. Yes, his name sounds like a character from Downton Abbey, but it's not his real name that really caught my eye. It was his nickname, which was One Slug McWhirter. What did this mean? Was he a lightweight with his whiskey, and one slug would put him under? No, supposedly he had brought down a Japanese plane with a single 50 caliber bullet. I will quote his Wikipedia page right here. Open quotes. He was nicknamed One Slug McWhirter after his first kill over Wake Island on October 5th, 1943. When McWhirter flew into a formation of Japanese Zeros and fired one 50 caliber bullet into the plane exploded and McWhirter earned his first enemy kill. The men in his unit said he was conserving the taxpayers' money by only firing one slug. McWhirter later stated that he only fired one shot because the plane blew up. Close quotes. Now this claim kind of drove me crazy. Is it possible to bring down a plane with one bullet? Is it even possible to only fire one bullet? Don't you pull the trigger and get a stream of them? Could Hellcat pilots select fewer than all guns, and then some jammed, and he tapped the trigger so lightly that only one gun fired one bullet, and that one did the deed? This was going to take a little investigating. Hamilton McWhirter was born and raised in Athens, Georgia, and attended the Georgia Institute of Technology and then the University of Georgia, completing the civilian pilot training program in 1940. He entered Navy flight training at Pensacola and was commissioned in 1942 and joined VF-9. He flew the F-4F-4 Wildcat off of USS Ranger and participated in Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa. Then they transitioned to the new F-6F Hellcat. In a later interview, McWhirter said this. Open quotes. When we came back from North Africa, we were scheduled to be the first squadron equipped with the F-4U Corsair. But Vought wasn't producing them fast enough, so we became instead the first to be given the Hellcat. It was like stepping out of a Model T into a Cadillac. The plane made carrier operations so much easier. Close quotes. On October 3, 1943, Commander Phil Torrey scored the very first Hellcat victory. McWhirter got the second, later recalling, "One of the Zeeks just appeared in front of me. I came up behind him and let him have a 1 second burst." Okay, so that was a 1 second burst, not a one bullet burst, but let's continue. Later on, after several other kills, often using very short bursts of fire, McWhirter secured his reputation as an economical shooter and saver of taxpayers' money. On a patrol near Tarawa on November 19, 1943, he received a call to intercept a bogey flying very low over the water. It was a Betty bomber at 2,000 feet. McWhirter said this about the attack, open quotes, "I made a flat side pass coming in on a starboard beam, aimed at the engines and nose, and gave it a 1 second burst. The port engine flamed, and the Betty hit the water and burned." Close quotes. When he landed, the armorers checked his ammo expended and came up with 86 rounds of ammo used. And that number included a test firing of the guns. So McWhirter certainly brought down the Betty with very few bullets, although not just one. That's still pretty good. as the Betty may not be a B-17 in terms of ruggedness and survivability, but it wasn't a rice paper pushover either. So McWhorter earned his one slug moniker and also became the first Hellcat ace. A few months later, he was the first Hellcat double ace. He stayed in the Navy until retiring in 1969. McWhorter's memoir, co-authored by Jay Stout, was published by Pacifica in 2001 and was named, fittingly, as the first Hellcat ace. Survivors. Following the Second World War, Hellcats continued to fly even though they were being replaced by the subject of an upcoming episode, the F-8F Bearcat. But Hellcats continued to be used for many other duties, including being the first aircraft to be used by the U.S. Navy's Blue Angels official flight demonstration team at its formation in 1946. Hellcats continued to fight, too. The French Navy used them in combat in Indochina from 1950 to 1952. And some were configured as pilotless attack drones carrying a 2,000-pound bomb. They were radio-controlled from a nearby flying sky raider and sent to dive into bridges in Korea. An even less glorious end were the Hellcats used as target drones. They were last used in actual service in the Uruguayan Navy until the early 1960s. Because of their vast numbers and long service life, there are many, many surviving Hellcats in static and airworthy condition. I've counted about 7 in airworthy condition, with 10 in static display and about a half dozen more being restored as we speak. Next time, we'll be looking at a plane that I've been looking forward to profiling because it looks so damn cool. The F-7F Tiger Cat. Thanks again to all who support the podcast through Patreon or PayPal. I appreciate it more than you know. You can also check out the photos of what we've been talking about on that Patreon page. These are available to all for free. Until next time.